On this episode of Florida Basketball Hour, we will break down Florida's Senior Day rout of Alabama. Gators dominate the Crimson Tide 105-87. We'll get into all the ways that that happened in an absolutely incredible environment in the O-Dome. The House of Horrors is back, baby. Gators 14-1 in Gainesville this season. Just tremendous performances throughout the year at home. The lone loss, of course, to Kentucky by 2 points on kind of a fluky Aaron Bradshaw triple. So, you know, could have been worse, I guess. Just a tremendous year for the Gators at home. And now as they look forward to playing one more road game and then on neutral sites from here on out, it's March, baby. It's an exciting time. So enjoy the show. Eric Fawcett and Neil Blackman will be bringing it to you and coming back with frequent episodes down the stretch here. Thanks for listening and enjoy. Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. On this episode, Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com, and myself going to break down Florida's 185, it seemed like that, 105-87 rout of Alabama on senior night. The Gators absolutely throttling the Crimson Tide for a senior night win, another quad one win, as Rocco Miller might point out, a quad 1A win. And also, like, it's amazing that Alabama continue to just get blasted by people on the road and, like, never move in KenPom. Like, they are, I mean, it's just missed. They have 10 losses and they're in the top 10 in KenPom. I'm not, and again, I hate to, I'm 50 seconds into the show and it sounds like I'm already wet blanketing Florida's win. I'm not. It was the most complete game that Florida played all season, I thought. And the Gators defended for 40 minutes.
Or how, yeah, I mean,
starter certainly defended that long. that was kind of new. Look. Good win for the Gators. Great win for the Gators, really. They can ruin all the goodwill they have if they lose at Memorial Gym on Saturday. We will actually get to that on this show, I promise. But I want to welcome in Eric Fawcett, who wrote a really great article on Leap Day about Florida's backcourt being built for March. And, like, you kind of saw it in this game because Alabama decided we're going to stay attached to shooters. And Florida's guards are like, awesome, wow. We're going to now eat you alive by getting the ball into the paint or getting into the paint ourselves, drawing contact, going to the line. I mean, it was just proof of how good and versatile Florida's guards are, in my view.
Yeah, I think that, a lot of people are kind of looking at, like, well, like, why are Florida's, like, what makes Florida's backcourt so good? And it's actually really interesting because when you look at both Walter Clayton and Zion Pullen, there's actually a lot that's, like, not great. I'm not saying it's, like, bad, but, like, again, we've talked about another Florida guard that struggles to finish at the rim. Walter Clayton and Zion Pullen aren't great. A lot of their playmaking numbers are okay. They're not great. But there's, like, one thing that they both do at an extremely high level, and that's make shots off the dribble. And that's something we've talked about on the podcast, yep. But I wanted to quantify it. And the numbers were actually still even a little surprising on that kind of note, where I think when everyone thinks, if I were to say who is the better mid-range shooter, I think a lot of people would say Zion Pullen. But it's actually Walter Clayton who has much better mid-range numbers. And if you said who's better at shooting the three off the dribble, I think a lot of people would have said Walter. Well, actually, people still might have said Zion Pullen. But Zion Pullen has incredible shooting off the dribble three numbers. And Walter Clayton's are actually not great, a little bit below average. But still, on the aggregate, they are both very, very good at shooting off the dribble. And I think just when you look at March and the tight games that happen and think about the biggest shots that you've seen in March, and not, like, again, I had a bunch of, like, people be like, well, what about the Christian Laettner shot? I'm like, okay, well, like, until that starts happening every single game where the ball gets heaved three-quarter court, usually it comes down to a guard who needs to make a shot off the dribble, and there's a number of reasons why. when defenses really crank up at the end of tight games. It's tougher to get to the rim. It's also, there's going to be like more help. There's going to be more inspired defenders coming to help. The refs are more likely to swallow their whistle. So it's just one of those things that there's a lot of factors that usually have the ability to shoot off the dribble. Just really amplified both at the end of the games, end of games, even in regular season, but especially in postseason play. And so it was something to quantify. And I guess that'll probably lead into something that I'm going to do on Patreon, probably after recording this podcast immediately. But we had some people asking about, again, like what's making Zion Pullen so good right now. So I'll probably do a little video on that. And, you know, spoiler, we're going to look at some of the shooting off the dribble. But I think with Alabama, you definitely saw it. And again, I think with Pullen especially, it's just something where he both combines the ability to physically overwhelm with, of course, still just, it's not just like he's a muscular guy just going down the lane like a bowling ball. He's also very skilled. So you definitely saw that. And Alabama's defense that has been just so poor showed itself to be so once again. And I know it's usually my job to be the wet blanket on Florida's wins. You kind of like pointed it out already, but I think that's like, if you know, this is now three losses out of four games for Alabama. And in every post game and press conference, Nate Oates is saying that his guys are not playing well. They're not practicing well. It makes it seem like everything's going wrong. So again, if you wanted like anecdotal kind of a, you know, context for Florida's win, it's like, on one hand, you could say like, yeah, Alabama is clearly not the ninth best team on, like they are indicated on KenPom. But also it's the net number that matters, and they have remained in the top 10 in net. And that makes it a really big win for the Gators, despite the fact that, I don't think there's too many people who actually think they're a top 10. And it's one of those things too. It's like a quad 1A win with a team that is not going to be seated anywhere close to being a top 10
right team.
And, but yeah, it's just like the matter of it. And I know like that's something that, like, I'll be honest, is grinding my gears a little bit about college basketball coverage at the moment. And just because it's not just fans, it's a lot of media, but there's a whole lot of people that are, this is so stupid. Whether it be the net, whether it be bracketing, all that. And everything does have an explanation. And that's what just kind of like annoys me a little bit. So is as much as it's like, yeah, they just like don't move in the metrics. It's like, okay, well, most of their losses are away. You know, they lost away to Tennessee. They lost away to Auburn. They lost away to Kentucky. They lost away to Florida. Teams that are solid in the metrics. They, of course, had neutral losses to Purdue and Ohio State, while Ohio State hasn't been very good, not terrible in the metrics. And then, of course, you see that when they do get wins, it's often by huge efficiency margins. And it's like they've got the recipe down. I think that people need to just remember to separate resume with metrics. And really, there always is an explanation. Every time on Twitter, I just saw someone complaining about like Syracuse's resume and why they were similar in one metric to another team that's on the bubble and they're not even close. And it's just like, hey, if you looked at like one of the other known inputs, you'd find your like every time someone complains about bracketology or seeding or like the answer is there, I promise you. So the fact of the matter is like the Gators have been on the beneficial side of a couple of teams that maybe look a little bit fraudulent, whether it's Auburn or whether it's Alabama. And again, you've got to separate how you would fill out your bracket from the metrics. If someone were to look at Florida and say like, look, I know that they have these technical big wins against Alabama and Auburn, but I don't think they're as good as those numbers would suggest due to you know, the context of those games. And of course we've talked about the context. Yeah, that's great. But on paper, they are massive wins that pretty much, you know, solidified the Gators in the NCAA tournament. Like we've talked about, like for sure, like for real this time. Like I know we've been talking about like what is a lock, anything like that. Like the Gators are now in a position where they could get blasted by Vanderbilt and get blasted in the first round of the SEC tournament, and they are still going to be in the NCAA tournament. So this is lock of all locks, I still saw a couple people still wondering, and I feel like it's just like PTSD of a couple of rough years of living on the bubble or being so outside of the bubble that even a big win gets you there. So there's some people that are still, I saw on Twitter, like, you know, like, what happens if the Gators lose to Vanderbilt? They are now in a position where, like, I think they could lose by 100 and lose by 100 in the SEC tournament, and they would still be in the NCAA tournament. So so that means that for the first time in a little while, we will look forward to podcasting on a Selection Sunday or close after.
Yeah, no, for sure. We'll organize a Selection Sunday plan for our listeners that are wondering about it. And I want to stay on the Alabama game a little bit. And I think another thing to point out about Alabama is, like, their schedule has just been, Eric alluded to it a little bit, like, these are road losses. Their strength of schedule is second in the country. Their non-conference strength of schedule is ninth. So it's not like, you know, it's just from SEC play either. Like, you don't get a strength of schedule at 2, a strength of schedule at non-conference strength of schedule at 9. If you aren't playing just monstrous teams pretty much all year, they've tested themselves. Now, you know, you can talk about whether they have a ton of great wins on their resume. They do not. But, you know, they're 14th in strength of record, which is really good. That's at least top 16 seed good, based on just strength of record. And then their metrics would put them at like a 3 seed. So, I mean, they're still a really good team. They just are struggling a little bit. And Florida, because Pullen and Clayton were able to get going off the bounce and get into the paint, I think it opened some things up for Will Richard. And he shot the ball well after sort of a 2-day funk. And I think Will, at this point, is just kind of having an up and down year. And it really sometimes almost is as simple as whether the first couple shots go in. But to see Will Richard have the team high 23 points, to see him grab some physical offensive rebounds, and to see him pick up some defensive steals, get some runouts, really, really good sign for Florida, hopefully, as they head into their most important games of the season.
Yeah, like, again, I've said it before, and this was a great game for the Will Richard index, where you can look at just Will Richard's line and know whether the Gators played well offensively. And it just seemed to be one of those games where Alabama's defense was terrible, and it just seemed like the balls kept finding Will Richard, which is exactly what you want from one of your best catch and shoot players, even as much as he's had some cold spells, which is really interesting because that was like literally the exact opposite of last season, where last season he just like never caught fire, but he was never cold. So he was always just like 1 for 3, 2 for 4, 2 for 5, 1 for 3, 2 for 4. Like you just said, like he just constantly had like those kinds of nights, and then it averaged out to, of course, a solid shooting year. And then this year you've got the go cold and then have a 5 for 9, game from 3. And you know what, like maybe last year the Gators could have used some of that variance. Like there's games where they probably could have used a guy that had the ability to go like 5 for 9 or something like that to get them out of some of those offensive droughts they had. But I think the Gators would still, he plays into a little bit of Florida's spurtability right now, where the backcourt has been generally pretty consistent. And then he is one of the guys where that has a little bit of that, you know, maybe can go for 20 plus if he's hitting a shot. So you love to see that from him. And again, he's someone who's going to be on the floor regardless, I feel, because of bringing a little bit of that defensive versatility, that the closest thing the Gators have to a big wing. So it just seems like he's going to be on the floor all the time regardless. And everyone is like universally happy about it, which says a lot about his game. He's like the one guy that I don't think anyone at even Walter Clayton scores a bunch of points and then he throws the ball away 3 times or dribbles it off his foot. And people are like, why is this guy on the floor? And we of course know, you know, Riley Kugel, and the front court has all had their times of guys, of people on Twitter, you know, being like, why isn't the next guy? And just because the front court's so deep, whenever someone plays badly, there's someone to say this guy should be in instead. But like everyone just loves Will Richard and sees what he brings. So because he's going to be out there anyways, you'd certainly like to see him get hot at the right time, because you know, as all these mid-major tournaments are happening, and you're seeing one game shooting variance either give teams life or just give them absolutely a devastating early ends to their season. That's something to weigh in with your shooters and wanting to make sure you're playing well at the right time. So definitely great for Will Richard.
Yeah, no, he was the Kimbom MVP in a game where really could have been any number of three players pulling, you know, with the seven assists and just the one turnover. Or I don't even know if he had a turnover. I think he had a turnover. No, I'm wrong. I'm sorry, Zion. No turnovers. Tyrese Samuel, saw a funny tweet. I forget who sent it, but it was like Tyrese Samuel should invite his sister to every single game because he was 9 of 9 at the free throw line with his sister in the house. Yeah, I mean, just really, really good from him, and kind of alluded to in the preview show by Eric Fawcett, like he wasn't sure why Tyrese didn't sort of take it at Alabama's front court in the first game. No problem with that in the home return version, and showing like a number of different post moves that he hasn't used really as much all season. There was a drop step. There were, you know, I mean, it was just really pretty basketball from Reese, and a big time senior night performance from a guy who's been pretty steady all year.
Yeah. And again, I just look at so many matchups, honestly, like not just in the SEC, but whoever the Gators have in the NCAA tournament. And this is, again, something that, like, I don't think people understand. Like, in, like, 2007, if you played big, it was for defense. And if you played small, it was for offense. Like, that completely changed in, like, 2011. So when the Gators decided they were going to play two centers at once, it was definitely a situation where they, well, should have known. I don't know if they did. I'm going to assume, because anyone who's studied basketball knows this, that they were going to be better offensively because of it, and they were going to struggle a little bit defensively. We've obviously seen that the defensive struggles are there, not exclusively due to playing big, but it certainly plays somewhat of a role. But because you have Tyrese Samuel at power forward, while you might be giving up something defensively, he almost has a mismatch in every single game. Like, there's not anyone who is, or there's very few people in the SEC, and that's and that's not going to change unless you see a Big Ten team in the NCAA tournament that's going to play a guy like that. So it's constantly a situation where he's either going to have a length or a physical mismatch. And it's something that, like, again, it's like you don't put two centers on the floor to not feature one of those guys. And it's usually the guy at the four. So I've kind of been, it was a little backwards to me that the Gators haven't been featuring him more, because that's like a baseball team, like, batting their designated hitter ninth. Like, why do you have a guy in a designated hitter? Like, why do you have, like, essentially a guy in an offensive position if you're not looking to play through that guy? So it's puzzled me a little bit. I've mentioned on the podcast, but, and again, in recent games where they have started to do it more, I think it's had tremendous results, and that happened against Missouri, happened now against Alabama. Yep. Another great opportunity would be to do that against Vanderbilt. But really, again, it's like, this isn't like, oh, just bully the bottom teams of the SEC or Alabama, who's pretty small in the front court for a team of that caliber-ish. I essentially, whoever the Gators play the rest of the way, like, Tyrese Samuel should have a mismatch. And again, it's like, if you're going to have a designated hitter, you put that guy in the cleanup spot. Like, you play through that guy and you put him in situations to, like, that's how it should work. So happy to see that. Happy to see that it's now been multiple games, not just bullying Missouri, but doing it against a team like Alabama. Like you said too, great for him to play so well on senior night, because the face of senior night has changed so much. And it is kind of the, like, while I think a lot of people would love to have 4-year players all the time, and there's something romantic about that, there's also something to be said about guys that, you know, come in right away that are, like, purely about, you know, winning. And there's, like, a different love that comes with a, you know, hired gun type situation. And you know, it's just different, but I think people Really do appreciate it. And the free throws was, of course, something stunning. Like, just watching it, you're like, as he's hit four or five in a row, you're like, okay, well, the next one's clanking out. And then six and seven, and you're like, oh, for sure, the next one. And again, while I like previously talked about bracketology and just like misinformation and people not just or people choosing to ignore information, like, I don't know. I'm at this point of the season where we hear too much. And hey, if nothing else, I'm consistent on this matter. Coaches arguing free throw discrepancy is almost always an outrageous thing to do. And again, there's always easy, 99.9% of the time, there's very easily accessible information that points to why there is a free throw discrepancy. But Nate Oates in the post game going after free throw discrepancy when they spent the last 6 minutes of the game intentionally fouling, or like trapping aggressively going for steals, and then in the post game talking about how many free throws Florida shot, I thought that was like just patently outrageous. And then again, like even on that, like there's national media talking about the game, which was great, because what do I keep talking about for years on this podcast? Florida needing to get back to national relevancy. You blast Alabama and there was a lot of conversation. And of course, and I'm not saying this is a negative, it's just like no one can watch every game. So there's definitely some national media that were talking about the game on podcasts, and they were like, oh man, Florida shot so many free throws. And then they use it as an example of like, that's how bad Alabama's defense is. And it was kind of funny to me because I was like, yes, Alabama's defense is bad, but like, look where those fouls came. So many of them came at the end. And then what have I said every time that Todd Golden complains about free throws? It's often games where the Gators cannot even get a paint touch. Well, Florida's getting a lot of paint touches against Alabama, and there was a whole lot of fouls. Like, there is correlation there. So I did think it was funny to see Nate Oates complaining about it for a number of reasons, both because Florida was getting to the rim with aggression, and then they were also, Alabama was just choosing to go really hard after steals because they had to. And with that, there's going to be fouls and semi-intentional fouls. So to see Tari Samuel knocking those down, is it enough to like vanquish the ghosts of season long where he's been, you know, under 60%? I won't personally buy it, but if you're looking for optimism, hey, maybe there's, you know, maybe in the NCAA tournament he can go 4 of 6 or 5 of 8 or something that's maybe a little bit more manageable than the possibility where you're like, oh, he might go 0 for 4 in a game, and it could be it could be huge or something like that. So I do think it's great to see him. And to people commenting on his sister being at every game, I mean, hey, the Gators make an NCAA tournament, hopefully that's it. That you know, that's legitimately a trip she can make. Maybe not, you know, a relatively nothing game against Vanderbilt, but hey, maybe SEC tournament. And hey, that's right. Certainly you'd hope at an NCAA tournament that that the family could make it down. And again, Tari Samuel being from Montreal didn't have a ton of a family contingent, which is unfortunate. Long way from Montreal, but I hope that they could maybe see him compete in wherever the Gators get sent in the first round of the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I saw. I mean, the Pullen family was Pullens were there, which is great because obviously he had a senior night last year at UC Riverside, so it's cool that they came out to Florida for his. And yeah, I mean, Samuel and Jack May had the smallest contingents, and you kind of expect that, one from Montreal, the other one, his dad might've been a little preoccupied, tough to make that trip. So, but Jack's mom was there. I did see that. And it looked like his grandfather was there, which is pretty cool. And they all got in, which also was pretty great. You know, it's not often you get to put your walk-ons in against Nate Oates, Alabama these days. So, you know, that was a cool thing just because it happened to fall on senior night. And, you know, you mentioned something that I think is super important, is like Florida has to consistently keep using Tyrese Samuel to attack these mismatches. And this game, they were able to foul Grant Nelson out after getting hurt by him last time. You know, he picked up a third foul very early in the second half. He had a second foul where Nate actually took him off the floor for a minute or two with the game. Like, Florida scored 20 points at the end of the first half. Like, it was a weird game because initially it seemed like everybody's going to have huge effort defensively. And like, Alabama had tired legs and a lot of their shots were short. And I saw like Twitter exploding, like, I can't believe they keep bringing up Alabama's tired legs. It's like, well, they are tired. They just played Tennessee like 2 nights ago. like it was a hard game for them. It's part of why that's conference play, man. It doesn't diminish what Florida did any more than it diminishes the fact that, like, you know, there were teams that got Florida. Ole Miss gets Florida on a Tuesday night after a brutally close game and loss against Kentucky, right? Is Ole Miss 23 points better than Florida? No. But they were that night because that's how conference play works. So, you know, I didn't have any problem with the announcers mentioning that, and credit Florida for taking advantage of that mismatch. Every time that Nick Pringle was in and the Gators would help on Sears or Estrada, Alabama would look for their duck ins with Pringle, and Tyrus Samuel gets four steals, two of which were just picking Pringle's pocket because he put the ball on the floor. Like, these are mismatched things that Florida took advantage of. So credit the Gators. Nate Oditz mentioned Florida. He thought Florida's game plan on both sides of the ball was very good. I thought it was too, Eric, and credit the staff for that.
Yeah, and I think that something I really liked about the way that they attacked Alabama was, the mismatch attacking. Like, we've talked about at length and don't need to go into it, that we don't necessarily love a lot of what Florida runs in the half court and don't think it's been particularly successful. So the simplification of, like, okay, we almost always are going to have a matchup at power forward, and we're almost always going to have a mismatch at one of the guard spots, because usually teams are not going to have two defenders in the backcourt that could take out guards of the caliber of Clayton and Pullen. So I like that Florida simplified a little bit, and that certainly is easier to do against a team like Alabama that's so poor defensively. But I think that there is, like, sometimes you get false positives when you play a team that's not very good defensively. I don't think this is a false positive. I think the Gators should really lean into the just attacking mismatches and not worry as much about trying to get into high low stuff with centers as passers, or trying to play out of some of their actions out of the low post. I think it should be get in the low post and clear, not try to run actions, not try to get into empty side ball screens with a bunch of action, and just get into a high ball screen with Walter Clayton and Zion Pullen and decide whether you want them to attack a single side or a double side and play out of it. I do think there was something there. And as much as I'll talk about Alabama's poor defense, and in the past, I do think the Gators have just overwhelmed bad defenses and got some false positives. I think they were onto something. I think they had a good plan and really did execute it, as you mentioned, or as Oates mentioned. And you hope that it's not like, well, that was good, now let's, like, see what we can do in the next one. Like, I think it's like, okay, that really worked. Like, why did that work?
Right.
And how can we continue to leverage those advantages moving forward? So let's hope that's the case, because there's false positives early. And maybe that's why the Gators kept going back to things that really weren't that good, because there was false positives. I really do think this was legit. So yeah, let's attack mismatches. Let's take advantage of Tyrus Samuel. Again, he's your designated hitter. Play through him. And usually you say I realize now that, like, there's people often use designated hitter in basketball to refer to someone as a real defensive liability. That's not the total case. But again, I would say he is when you play big, that player is brought in to be an offensive mismatch. And that's the case. So yeah, we'll of course see how exactly the brackets break down in the SEC and NCAAs. But yeah, this is something for the Gators that I hope that they continue.
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly something to build on. Another thing, and I like the way that you, just sort of referenced things that you can build on and something to move forward with, because we did have a Patreon question. We have two former players at Florida. This is not a humble brag. It's kind of a humble brag. It's a humble brag that's an intro to a question. I'm not going to say it's not one. But we have two former players at Florida. One, a former All-American, Udonis Haslam. One, a former All-SEC selection and All-NCAA regional selection, Mike Rosario. And Mike Rosario wanted to know what Eric Fawcett thought of the development of Denzel Aberdeen. He said, it seems like he's finally playing within himself, which is really helping Florida. It was good to see Coach Golden credit him for providing eight quality minutes the other night. So just kind of, you know, touch on that. I'm not sure how much we'll see Denzel down the stretch in games in March, but I did think, I think Mike is right that there's been some progress in terms of him not forcing things and just becoming kind of a productive complementary player on the floor this season. Eric, your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mike. I think the thing with Denzel Aberdeen, and it's just it's the challenge for so many young players is I think Denzel Aberdeen is best with the ball in his hands offensively, and I think he's best guarding the ball defensively. But when you're a young player on a team with a lot of talent and a lot of veterans, when you come into the game, you're probably going to be off the ball in both settings. So I think earlier in the season, you saw him come in, didn't have the ball in his hands, and he was forced to be a floor spacer. And we saw earlier in the season, he didn't shoot the ball particularly well off the catch. And we saw him have some breakdowns as a help defender. And then I think when you look at what he did against Alabama, and you've even seen a little bit earlier against Vanderbilt, and actually he played decently against Alabama defensively in the first game. And then maybe that's why he got a little bit of an opportunity in this one again. But I think when you see him come in and actually have the opportunity to have the ball in his hands, like you of course saw him hit that step back. That was like pretty crazy, but that's like, while I'm not suggesting he should take a bunch of those step backs, I think it did point to something of like we talked about with Riley Kugel. He's someone who's better shooting off the bounce than off the catch. So earlier in the season, when he was put in a position to play off the ball and he could only shoot off the catch, he's not making shots. Then he has the opportunity to get on the ball and you start to see that kind of juice. And I think that's where you start to see a little bit more about what he is and what he could be. Like when you think of like the best Denzel Aberdeen plays in your head right now, it's not the ball getting reversed to him and him attacking a closeout, or it's not him ripping catch and shoot threes. It's all been him taking guys in isolation. We saw that step back three. And then defensively, we've also seen he's someone that I think is again, just best when he can just absolutely dog a ball handler. Someone who is maybe not as good in the gaps as some other players, but and maybe not the most high IQ help defender yet, but you put him on the ball and he's a really quick footed 6'5" player with really disruptive hands. So to me, it's just the utilization of him. And then that's also why you wonder if, if we're going to see him that much, because you just have to wonder if with a team that has the guards that Florida does that are older players, how does Denzel Aberdeen get in that mix? But I mean, hey, we've seen some games where they needed to go to either Riley Kugel or Denzel Aberdeen, and Denzel Aberdeen was the first guy off the bench. And I think you just wonder if that's something that that continues. But yeah, I certainly there's been some development with the confidence of Aberdeen to play the way he does when he has the ball in his hands. But I think that's the biggest thing I've seen is just like, is he a very good catch and shoot player playing off the ball? Maybe not so much. Does he have some juice with the ball? Absolutely. Same thing defensively. And I think that's if he can get 7 minutes hawking the ball defensively, that's maybe the role we see him in the rest of the way. And if not, I don't think it has anything to do with him as much as the excellent play of the guards in front of him. And I guess like maybe there's a world where you hope he doesn't play because it means Riley
right.
Kugel is playing pretty well. Because especially if Riley Kugel is playing well, suddenly there's a whole lot of guards in front of him. But I also think there's a world where a lot of people, like I think there's a lot of people right now, like say it was the NCAA tournament tomorrow and it's like, 2020 game midway through the first half. And they've got to put in Riley Kugel or Denzel Aberdeen. I think there's a lot of people that even right now at this moment would prefer Denzel Aberdeen, who's probably not going to, who is not shown the same ability to explode offensively, but also hasn't shown the same issues turning over the ball or breaking down. So like, you know, there's certainly some trust there, but as you see so much roster turnover in college basketball, I think there's a lot of people that, you know, we talked about when will the Gators have another four-year player on the other podcast before the Alabama game. And I think that there's
times where you're like,
oh, maybe. Yeah, you did. And it's one of those things that I could see it go either way, because that's a guy that like, you know, you wonder if he, like, the next step for him is, or the next year is, like, does he take the next step, or does he, you know, maybe think about going somewhere where he can play more minutes. But yeah, I think that he's got enough fans, and you even see the trust a little bit with the coaching staff that maybe that's someone who sticks around for a little while.
Yeah, no, I hope so. I thought he hit one of the two biggest shots in that game the other night, by the way. Florida had an empty possession where they were still behind. And they didn't really run anything. I love that Jimmy Dykes was like, Florida's not running anything on this possession too. Like, Jimmy, I mean, I get it. People either love Jimmy or they don't like Jimmy. I really feel like it's become, like, so polarizing. And I think he's great. Like, I think he explains things and distills information in a very direct way. I think he falls in love with home crowds. And I personally don't think that that's a problem. Like, I think we want that in college basketball from a color guy. Like, I want you to be enamored with the atmosphere. I want you to say that the refs got it right when they probably got it wrong, because you're in love with the home crowd. Yeah. Like, that's, to me, that's fun, right? Anyway, I think Jimmy's really good. And he also will call people out. Like, he called out Alabama for how they were just, you know, hopelessly clueless again, that Zion Poland was, like, an elite mid-range player. Like, they're slacking off of him. Well, yeah, that is dumb. Good for you for calling it out. So on this possession, Florida had nothing. There wasn't any movement. The ball was really sticking. Aberdeen gets a pass and hits a three-pointer. You know, huge shot for him. Not the look Florida wanted, but good for him for having the confidence to knock that down. And then the other one, I think that the more, I guess, that maybe is a deep cut, whereas the more obvious big shot was Will Richards' shot in the second half, where Florida had four consecutive empty possessions. Mark Sears had just made a bucket. The lead was 16, but it kind of felt like, uh-oh, here we go again, because Mark Sears just hit a shot. We fully expect Mark Sears to hit, like, three logo threes in a row coming up. And Will Richard buries a triple. And from that point, this game was not going to be one where Florida lost that lead in an incredible environment, Eric.
Yeah, I think that there was maybe a little bit of, at least fans seeing ghosts of blown double digit leads in the past. But I think, like you said, when that three went through, that was kind of like, okay, it seemed like Alabama only had one punch left in them. When Will Richard kind of ended it, it just seemed like there wasn't a lot left in the tank. And again, like, Lachelle Reitzel back in action for Alabama didn't really look like himself. Again, you miss a couple of weeks, especially when you're a shooter. Like, it's pretty tough to get that rhythm back right away. So Aaron Estrada, like, had some excellent moments, but also wasn't the kind of killer he was in the first game. And I mentioned before, like, Grant Nelson to me was just the absolute worst fit at Alabama. I would be fascinated to talk to Alabama staff about that take. Do I think that, like, well, like, one, and again, I don't even think this is disrespectful to say, but I just, does Grant Nelson belong on a roster of a top 15 college basketball team? In my opinion, no. And that was the kind of aspirations that Alabama had, and that was the kind of resources they had in terms of the player they could go after. So, That's one thing. It just it in a vacuum, is he should be on it? Should he be on a roster like that? No. And then, does he fit what Alabama wants to do? Absolutely not. Not in any way. So I actually, you know, and I hope he's having a great experience at Alabama, but I don't think that fit is very good. But he's also so relied upon that even though it's not a great fit, it's not like he's getting buried. He's got to be out there. But I mentioned that this was a couple not great games for him in a row. And then, even though he was very good against the Gators and in the first matchup, was not very impactful against the Gators this time. And yeah, again, and then you mentioned the crowd. That was fantastic. And it was just one of those things that, like,
unbelievable.
It feels like the Gators were, you have an Alabama team that's playing horrible, that doesn't match up particularly well with the Gators, and the Gators are playing pretty well. They've got momentum. Alabama's going the exact opposite way. And then you've got a crowd like the one in Gainesville. And it just was, that's why you have a tsunami of it just, like, again, he just felt like it was just like, snowballed very quickly for Alabama. Yeah. Like you said, there was that one little push where you thought, oh, maybe Alabama's got something left, and it got closed. And speaking about actually the I mentioned fouls earlier, but like it's one of those things that also we really should mention, like as much as we've been talking about offense and attacking the mismatches and guys who have mismatches, like this is a game where the final score really didn't have anything to do with how the game looked, because the Gators, I really think, defended very well. And Alabama getting up to 1.09 points per possession, I believe. I don't know. That didn't really feel like that was the case. And they had a bunch of free throws at the end of the game. They had some, well, there was a lot of garbage time in this game. So you did see Mark Sears put up some good, and I'm not saying this to be negative against Mark Sears. I think he's tremendous, but the fact of the matter is he did put up a lot of points in garbage time. So it's actually one of those things as well that, like, I really think that Florida's defense in that first half was as good as they have played this season, to be honest with you. And it wasn't like the results were outstanding. I think it was 35 points for Alabama. I don't know the points per possession. Obviously, it's a pretty high possession game, so still 35 points is really, yeah, really good. But I do think that players like Walter Clayton and Zion Pullen, who haven't always been great perimeter defenders this year, I really thought they stepped up. And we have talked about how the Gators have been pretty good in the gaps with their length, but I think it really started with some of these guys like Walter Clayton taking a little bit more pride on the defensive end in their individual matchups. So if you're also looking for motivation, like I really do think Florida defended super well in this game, and it's kind of unfortunate that they won't get credit for it, because there was like 10 minutes of garbage time where, like, yeah, Alabama got loose a little bit and like ended up with over a point per possession. But like, there was a chance where, like, I think midway through the game, I sent a message to a group chat where I'm like, man, the Gators are going to absolutely skyrocket up in KenPom, because they're going to hold this Alabama team to like 72 and like under a point per possession. And because Alabama is a legendarily great offense, right. Florida's defense is going to take an absolute, like a massive, like I was actually like, I bet Florida's defense is going to take like a 15 spot leap. But unfortunately, Alabama gets a bunch of garbage time buckets and gets their offensive numbers up. But like, really, for 25 minutes, the Gators played very, very well defensively against what entering this game was one of the greatest offenses of the last 25 years. And yeah, I kind of feel like even in our first half hour of conversation, I've kind of forgot to mention that.
Yeah, no, I mentioned it at the very top, and then kind of.
Oh, there you go.
I got away from it too. Florida's up to, so their defense is 39th in defensive efficiency in their last 10 per Torvik, and entering the Alabama game, it was 52nd. So like, they got a pretty big leap just in Torvik on that number, which I thought was pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, I thought Florida in particular, like Zion Pullen, I thought it was just really good defensively. And I say that knowing that like, he had a lot of possessions on Mark Sears, who ended up with an absurd number of points. But Will Warren has a good site, Stats by Will. It's like a Substack. And this was the most lopsided quad one shot quality game in the SEC this year. Like, it was 113-70 in shot quality. So Florida actually missed some looks they probably would have made. And Alabama, mostly because of Mark Sears, like, made some really tough shots too. So, you know, and I know Eric and I have kind of laughed off some of the shot quality stuff, but like, when it's that disparate, it's pretty funny that like, it certainly at least can be sort of an instructive additional data point, I think. I thought Florida really, really defended quite well. I mean, even a couple of Grant Nelson's makes in the first half, you know, really well defended plays, either Tyrese Samuel. Nelson made one where he was like falling down. You know, Condon, who got elbowed in the head again in this game, was just incredulous that Nelson actually made the shot. Condon and Hawk played good. Hawk continues to be an impressive help defender for me, maybe Florida's best help defender right now. Lots to hopefully be encouraged by, because again, whatever you think of Alabama, their offense is historically awesome.
Yeah, and they we've seen it the way that they turned on the Jets in the first game against the Gators, and obviously you want to look at more sample size than just the way they play against the Gators, but like they have hung a lot of points on a lot of good defenses, and I think that really that could be the most encouraging part about this game is not the offense, not the way that maybe they found something, but the way that they were able to defend and hey, that's when you play some of your best offense and some of your best defense of the season. That's how you have one of your biggest games of the year. And I think that's gotta be awfully encouraging. I'm trying to look over this box score, see if I have anything left on this one. And I don't really think I do, other than, you know, got to shout out Alex Condon once again, who is also excellent. Again, just speaks to like when you're talking about the way that Florida can just overwhelm some teams, like there was times where it was like Ryland Griffin having to play the four, and like you saw like Alabama desperately trying to get something out of Jaren Stevenson, and it just like he's just not ready. Like that's just a freshman who's I think going to be very good, but just relied on a little bit too much. Yeah, I don't know if I have anything more to say on this game, but what about you? Any more thoughts?
No, ready to talk Vanderbilt's full court press that I think is probably coming in the first half, and certainly some zone defense. I know Jerry Stackhouse will throw that out. Got to remember, they got seniors too. It's their senior day. They've been a better team slightly at home this year. It's a funky place to play. We've talked about that for 6 years. No need to get super into that. Like if I'm Florida, I guess like what I'm thinking is Zion Pullen he was plus 25, which is stupid, but he also was 1 of 7 from the field and had 2 points the last time Florida played Vanderbilt, and Riley Kugel played 6 minutes and had 2 points. And Florida still had 20-point leads multiple times, even though the press kind of allowed Vanderbilt to get the backdoor cover. It's a quad three game. Florida hasn't lost one of those this year. But, you know, every time you go to Nashville, like every single coach in the SEC is nervous. And Florida's coming off a huge win. So I think a challenge to stay focused given everything that's ahead of Florida after this.
Could you give a rundown of the standings situation, because I'm going to give the overarching take of this game really doesn't have much
sure.
standings implications for the Gators, which if you're also looking for a concern, you could certainly point to the fact that for the Gators, it's like, it doesn't really matter. For Vanderbilt, it certainly doesn't matter. They're locked into the 13 seed of the SEC tournament, so doesn't really matter for them, you wonder where motivations will be for both teams, and maybe it is the senior thing that could be more of a motivation, let's talk, because I know a lot of people were like, oh, like, but the Gators are only a half or one game back, so like they could finish as high as fourth, right? So I think this would be a great opportunity for you to clear up just exactly where things sit.
Yeah, so Florida can finish fourth. There's a number of things that kind of have to happen for that to occur. And so let's talk about some of those. Assuming I can. Yeah, okay, I've got it all here. And I wrote some of these down in anticipation of the show. So first thing that has to happen is Kentucky has to lose to Tennessee. That game's in Knoxville. Tennessee beat Kentucky at Rupp Arena. In the first game. So pretty decent chance that Tennessee finishes 15-3 in the SEC and wins. Now, the next thing that Florida needs to happen is South Carolina needs to lose at Mississippi State. Now, that's possible. But if that happens, then there's a three-way tie between Kentucky, South Carolina, and Florida, assuming the Gators win at Vanderbilt. Now, that would get everybody to 12-6. And in that scenario, South Carolina would win the three-way tiebreaker, and it would get a bye. And then Florida would lose the tiebreaker to Kentucky, and even then they would be the sixth. So how do things get complicated? There's two ways that Florida could have a different seeding than six. And the first scenario involves Mike White winning at Neville Arena. So if Mike White and Georgia win at Auburn, and then it doesn't matter what happens in the other games I mentioned, Florida goes to the five if they win. If Auburn loses, Florida wins a tiebreaker against Auburn because of head-to-head, the Gators are the five seed. Now, the real funny stuff is if Kentucky and South Carolina lose, which I think are kind of probable outcomes, actually, because it's hard to win at the hump, and Miss State's pretty good, and they need another quad one win to really feel good on Selection Sunday. And then Kentucky and Tennessee. Tennessee's just a better team, and they're playing at home on their senior day. And I don't think there's an army that could beat Tennessee on Zakai Ziegler and Dalton Connect Day in their own arena. But let's say Georgia wins. In that four-way tie, Florida's the four seed. And the reason, the reasoning is kind of complicated, but it really has to do with the way it ends up working out is you look at everybody's record versus the top two seeds in that scenario, and then everybody's record against one another. And when you throw all of that into a hat, Florida comes up just a little bit better than everyone else and ends up with the four. So that's the scenario for Florida on the double bye. Otherwise, they're more or less locked in to that six seed spot, Eric.
Thank you so much for doing that. I did not have all those figured out, so I had a feeling you would, so that's perfect. I was looking at some modeling just to see, like, give a little bit of a percentage chance. And again, these numbers are, you know, somewhat dubious. It's college basketball, and there's a lot of randomness. But one model has the Gators with a 3% chance at the four seed, a 21% chance at the five seed, and that would leave a 76% chance at the six seed. So, yeah, there's just you know, give everyone a somewhat of an idea of yeah. So, yeah, you know, fairly unlikely for the four seed, but Neil, you laid out what needs to happen. And I also I saw someone tweet at the show, asking who to root for in order to for the Gators to be the four seed. And so I'm glad you kind of laid that out. But it also reminded me of something that, like, I haven't plugged on the show for a couple of years because the Gators haven't been relevant for a couple of years. But one really fun tool on Bart Torvik's website, if you go to Bart Torvik, you go click on Florida's team profile or any profile if you also like other teams or are interested in other teams. There's a rooting guide. So you can go to and look for, and that's not SEC tournament, that's NCAA tournament. But you can go and click on Florida's site or profile. You can go to the rooting guide and you can look at every game that has any semblance of benefit to the Gators if a team wins or loses. And it can be kind of fun if you're into that to go look and see, oh, I want this team to lose because according to most brackets, they're, you know what, they're a higher six seed than the Gators, or they're, you know, they're a six seed and the Gators are a seven. So you want those teams in front to drop. And it's really fun. And I also think it's also just a really good reminder to people that, and again, I just say this, I've said this a few times, I'll say it again. I do think a lot of fans, whether it be about the AP poll or whether it be about bracketology, they just, and everyone does this, this isn't just Florida fans, but like everyone looks at their team in isolation. So it's always like, oh, we won a game, we should move up. We lost a game, I guess we're moving down. And it's like that plays a role, but there's so much going on outside of your team. And again, I thought that was a problem earlier when people were tweeting at the show and like, why shouldn't the Gators be ranked? They just beat a team that's 77th in the net. And it's like, well, because a lot of other teams got better wins that week. And again, I think that there's still a lot of that conversation with like, I swear to God, and I won't say this person's name, but like when the Gators were like a nine seed in most brackets, like they won a game and he's like, oh, I guess. And I could show you the messages in order where it was like the Gators won a game. Oh, so we're an eight seed. Then they won another game. Oh, we're a seven seed. Oh, they lost a game. oh, we're a 7 seed still. Then they won a game. Oh, we're a 6 seed. Then they won a game. And so in his mind, the Gators are just getting seed lines with every single win. And it's like, that's not really how it works. Not just because seed lines are that easy to get, but also because like you can't look at your team in isolation. So looking at the rooting guide to see how much is going on in the college basketball universe that affects where a team sits is a really good reminder to people that you cannot just look at Florida and whether or not Florida wins or loses. So anyways, super fun tool. So those are two tools to just get into this, both Bartorvex and then looking at some modeling. So so I guess the Gators are most likely a 6 seed in the SEC tournament. I will also ask you, Neil, like obviously a double bye would be great. So I think without that, sure. That goes without saying. If you could be a 4 seed, snap your fingers and the Gators are a 4 seed, you would take that, I think, about 100% of the time. Maybe you have a hot take about who you could run into, but I'm wondering, like, as you look at the bracket, does it matter to you all that much between a 5 or a 6 seed? And again, I know also once again, can't look at this in isolation because the rest of the standings are also going to move. But is there like anything to you that suggests a 5 seed is much better than a 6 seed?
No, not really. I mean, either way, if Florida's the 6, you can make the argument it's better to even be a 6 because Auburn and Alabama are on that side of the bracket. Florida's beat them. Florida played Tennessee once. Granted, it was in Knoxville, but there was the weird ice storm. The arena wasn't even completely full. It was like 70% full, 75% full. Florida got waxed. So, you know, it's hard to see Florida winning a semifinal against Tennessee anyway. Oh, by the way, so let me add the third fun tool. Torvik has a conference tournament simulator.
Oh,
which is super fun. And so in the current seeding, Florida has the best chance of any team that doesn't have a double bye. Well, no, that's not true anymore because I just ran. I populated it. Florida has the fifth best chance to get to the final. Their chance of getting to the final with the current seeding structure is a little better than South Carolina's. At 13.5% over 13.1%. But with the current seeding model, there's a 34.7% chance that Tennessee wins the tournament. There's a 30.7% chance that Auburn wins the tournament. And then Florida's is 5.7% for those that are interested. But you can keep running the conference tournament simulation model based on all the seedings at Torvik. I love that tool. I think it's super fun. I wanted to shout out a couple of Patreons real quick. New members, because we got a lot of them lately. And we appreciate all of you. Ben Betts, Six Man Club. John, Six Man Club. Jake Buckle, Six Man Club. Jeff Clark, Six Man Club. Jake McCauley, Six Man Club. Udonis Haslam, Rowdy Reptiles. So thank you all for joining. Those are some of our newest Patreon members. I did put up a post. And I'm not going to do too much bracketology because that's what we don't do, these Patreon posts and then give away the content on the pod. But I did do a Patreon this morning about bracketology, a snapshot of where Florida is. And I will tell you, the only spoiler I'll give is that I really get into some who the accurate bracketologists are and where they have Florida. And the bracket matrix average right now, as of 11 p.m. last night, was Florida as a 7 seed, as the highest 7 seed, which would put them in Charlotte. And before everybody's really pumped about Charlotte, remember that North Carolina would be there if they get a 2. And I don't know how much we want that smoke. North Carolina in basically a road game in the round of 32. And I actually am guilty of texting Eric and saying, I'm not sure that North Carolina matches up great with Florida, which I genuinely believe in my heart.
I would take them over a number of teams. And again, kind of appears that
on the road, that's tough. I think
that is true. That plays a role, but like I also would look at the, like, what if the alternative, and like, to me, I think that Tennessee should be the 4th, like a common discussion right now. And one of the actually like good and interesting bracketology discussions, there's a lot that are not, but is whether or not Arizona or Tennessee should be the last 1 seed. The first 3 1 seeds are like all but decided. I think it should be Tennessee. A lot of people think it should be Arizona. There's very good arguments on both sides. But one of the sites is also, you know, like Memphis. And if could you accidentally run into Tennessee in Memphis, where I'm sure they'd have a decent showing. And that was actually, I was going to also lead in because, again, knowing that Charlotte, your lovely hometown, is now is one of the first round destinations or locations, I should say. It's going to be interesting. Like Brooklyn is one of the first round sites. There's Omaha in the Midwest. You know, there's a few interesting ones for sure. But it's, you can also do a little bit of reverse engineering if you want to like really get in the weeds, knowing that there's 3-1 seeds essentially decided. And you can kind of tell that, like, well, UConn is going to be at Brooklyn because that's close, and Purdue's going to be in Indianapolis. And then you can start to say, oh, well, so if that's where those games are going to be in the first round. Okay, well, if the Gators are, you know, a 6 seed or a 7 seed, that would put them, you know, here. And you can start to kind of even figure out. So if you're someone who's looking at maybe traveling to see the Gators play, or depending on if it's close, you can actually even start to do that. And it's also a little bit of a sad, I've had a sad couple of weeks because I'm starting to lose a little bit of faith in bracket matrix. I think they need to be more gatekeepy, to be honest with you. I think there are some people that there are some brackets that are bracketologists, quote, that are just not all that serious, that are allowed in the composite. And there's also people, like, one of the issues right now is there's some people that are updating every single day and some that aren't. So it's also very difficult to get it used to be a situation where, like, it's the morning of March 8th, we could refresh. Essentially everyone would have updated the last night. And if not, it would be for sure like the day before. So like you'd essentially have all updated brackets. There's some people that are doing it once a week that are in there. So I will say I'm someone who's, and still I will use bracket matrix as my just catch all. Like, I still think it's the best way if you just want to say like a team is this seed. I still think the composite bracket matrix is still probably the best way to, I do think it's the best way to do it, but I don't think it's as good as it once was. So I might have to start leaning a little bit more into like everyone knows, I really like Lucas Harkins at HeatCheck. He's got an excellent resume over what is now the last 4 years. I do wonder if I might have to start leaning on the guys that have proven to be really accurate. I like the idea of the composite, but I think that there's 90 brackets in bracket matrix right now. I think that there should be like 55, but anyways, I'll still use bracket matrix, but I will give that caveat of my trust in bracket matrix is not what it once was. So, and just for people to keep that in mind, because we always talk about bracket matrix, if people are looking at it for themselves, yeah, just even you can take a look and see when people updated their bracket last. So sometimes you'll see like right now, if you were like, oh, the Gators are a 5 seed, it might be like a week and a half. It might have been updated like a week and a half ago, or like it's like, oh, the Gators are a, you know, the lowest 9 seed, and you might look, oh, it hasn't been updated in a little while. So just keep that in mind, particularly with outliers.
Yeah, I like that. And I will say, without giving away much of the Patreon content, that one of the things I mentioned was that even among the 10 most accurate bracketologists in the last 3 years, which is kind of how I filtered it out, or 5 years, sorry. There were, okay, so everybody had done an update as of March 5th. But the thing about that is the Florida-Alabama game was March 5th. So 1, 2, 3... Four, five of the top 10 hadn't updated to reflect Florida's win over Alabama. Now, Lucas Harkins has, I think. Nope, he hasn't either. He's a March 5th update.
I'm gonna text him.
So Lucas is, his most recent is it. So one that has is Jake Liker, who was the bracketology champion of the world last year. So Jake Liker has Florida as an 8, and he's updated as of March 8th. He has a bracket up this morning where the Gators are an 8 seed in the South. That would be Houston's region in his bracket. I'm not sure what Jake doesn't like about Florida, that he's still got Florida on that 8 line, but he was the champion of the world last year in bracketology, and he was in the top 5 the year before that. So this is one of the most accurate ones the last 2 seasons. as Florida's an 8 seed. All right, I'm not spoiling any more Patreon stuff.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I think that's another situation where I think you just look at some of the sevens, like he probably had Gonzaga jump the Gators, and Gonzaga, who was left for dead in the middle of the season, is now on a tear, and what they looked like they were going to miss the NCAA tournament. I think a lot of people have them as a seven, and you're also seeing I haven't looked at his exact bracket, but like that is a situation like where you're seeing it's just a good example to not look at Florida in isolation, because there's a lot of other things going on. And I'd have to imagine that would be my prediction. Maybe even looking at it, you can tell me I'm wrong, but like Gonzaga is a perfect example, right? Leapfrogging Florida. Like me saying that Gonzaga just leapfrogged Florida probably has some listeners sick right now, because there's always Gonzaga haters. And also because if you follow the sport, maybe casually, but enough to know that Gonzaga was again left for dead after non-conference play. And they just had a huge, huge win over St. Mary's, and that's a pretty huge resume win for them. And there's a lot, just so many inputs to things like this. But I will also say, I know I've seen some people who think the Gators should be a 6 seed. That does still sound a little bit rich for me. It really does seem that 7 is where I thought they would be. So I'm very surprised to hear that 8, to be honest with you, but maybe I need to do a little bit more investigating.
Yeah, he's got him as an 8. You're right. He has Gonzaga jumping them. His 7s, just so people know, because it's kind of interesting, are St. Mary's, Gonzaga, Boise State, and Texas. That would be the one that I would not agree with him about. I think Florida has a better body of work than Texas. I think Florida is objectively a better basketball team than Texas. I think anyone that watched Baylor just absolutely annihilate Texas after they played with their food for 10 minutes has got to know that Texas is not 7 seed good. Like Texas to me, like if Florida wasn't an 8-9 game and they played Texas, like other than Max Abmas scoring like 50 on Florida again in the NCAA tournament, I would not be that concerned with that game. But maybe that's just me.
That one again is like earmarked for remember when Furman played Virginia in the NCAA tournament, and right. Furman was like favored on KenPom, and Furman was favored by the betting markets, and there was all these like numbers floating around that was like, there are like millions and millions of dollars more bet on Furman than like, and it was just like literally everyone thought that Furman was going to beat Virginia, and then they did in somewhat dramatic fashion, but it was just one of those things where it's like, it's not that wasn't to suggest that like Furman should have been a better seed than Virginia, but again, it's just seeds do not always equal. Like, again, I feel like South Carolina, Auburn, Alabama, like that, those could be teams that all have like better seeds than they actually are as teams, and will probably be faded accordingly by a lot of people. But you gotta, at the same time, it's resumes are different than who really is the best team, unfortunately. But at the same time, I actually still do agree with you. While I do think that you've got to separate how good a team is from their resume, I don't think Texas's resume is very good, but the Big 12 just gives you so many opportunities, and they're a product of that. And so that is interesting. So anyways, we got into a lot. This is maybe a preview of what I'm wondering if we'll end up doing, and maybe we need to talk about it right after we stop recording this podcast, of what we might do. But this sounds like maybe a little bit of a bracket preview Patreon type thing we might end up doing. I don't know. We'll talk about it.
Sounds good, man. I'll let Eric sign us off as Florida gets ready to play its last regular season game. Goes quick.
Go Gators, and keep attacking closeouts.